listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 27th installment of our conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the political economy and history of the Soviet Union. Welcome, Luciana.
Good morning, Don.
So,
we
made it to 1917.
Yeah, we're moving from 1912 to 1917, when in October the Bolsheviks seized power not through a coup, but through a revolution. There's a difference.
That's right.
A revolution is not a coup. A coup is a counter-revolution. An attempt at coup in the year 1917 did occur, and it was in August. I get confused with July and August, but let's say July, August 1917, during the Kornilov affair, we should call it.
What do they call it? They call it the Kornilov uprising or the Kornilov mutiny or something. I forget the term.
Yeah, I guess the
Kornilov affair will do.
Yeah, All right.
Yeah, let's call it the Kornilov affair. That works.
Okay. And we need only mention it here for an interesting thing that happened that helped the Bolshevik Revolution. Anyway, Kornilov was appointed by Kerensky, by the provisional government, set up by the February Revolution. Kornilov was appointed by Kerensky to lead, to head the army, but Kornilov seems to have taken upon himself to move on Petrograd, and Kerensky feared that he would be overthrown in a military dictatorship or, would be installed. Now, right. We're not going to talk in depth about this because there are all sorts of interpretations of whether Kerensky was in cahoots with Kornilov and blah, 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 blah. But at any rate, this Kornilov did threaten the Kerensky rule. So
right.
What happened that is important to us is that Kerensky was forced to distribute arms to the Bolsheviks. And these arms were kept. To the Bolsheviks, meaning the people in the masses
right.
in the
Soviet.
In
the streets, right.
It also forced Kerensky to let out all sorts of Bolsheviks in prison in the July operation that he conducted against the Bolsheviks. This was, chaos. So Kornilov was very helpful to the 1917 revolution in a
right, it's sort of a backhanded way. You know, and let me correct myself here, too, just for emphasis. Really, it's more accurate to say that they were in the hands of the Soviets than of the workers who were in the Soviets rather than in the streets. Because, in fact, the Soviets were the actual workers' organizations that had the real workers leading the real organizations that were the real backbone of the revolution.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
This wasn't like a mob spontaneous uprising that took place. This was an worker organized, under the leadership of the Bolshevik Party, worker organized revolution, which is
distinct. The 1917 October. You
that's
mean?
That's right. Well, that's what those are the people. Yeah. The guns end up in their hands, and so when it's time for the revolution, they got the guns.
Exactly. And so it's important, though, to note that at least we say that the October Revolution was not a coup.
Right.
I mean, that the October Uprising was not a coup, but a revolution.
Correct.
Because why, Don?
Well, first of all, I mean, because it's the reality of it. And the thing, the slander against that reality is based on the fact that they characterized the Bolsheviks as some sort of revolutionary elite that was, the embryonic version of the dictatorship by the bureaucrats that would follow. In other words, they were saying, in essence, these people usurped the revolution and put themselves in charge, and that is a coup and not a revolution. And that's, in fact, not what happened at all.
No. And so a revolution is a change in class rule and class power. And that revolution had actually happened in February. That is a change in class rule from the feudal aristocracy of the Tsar regime to a bourgeois-style revolution in February. So there had been this type of revolution, a change in power from aristocracy, feudal aristocracy, absolute monarchy, to a, let's call it democratic bourgeois revolution for the time being.
Right.
But if the Bolsheviks had enacted a coup in October 1917, I mean, that would mean that they were going to reinstate the Tsar's regime, if we take coup as counter-revolution.
Right.
Definition as counter-revolution.
Right, they would restore the status quo ante to the first part of the revolution. Right.
Oh, and worse, and more, and you know,
more repressive.
More punitive.
Right, like we saw after 1905, right?
Yeah, and instead, the October Revolution extended power to more people, to a new class, which will be the workers and the peasants. So they didn't reinstate the Tsar regime. It wasn't a coup. And so to go back to, let me see here, I'm losing the thread of my thought. So if the Bolsheviks had enacted a coup in October 1917, that would have meant that they had reinstated the Tsar regime, as we said, which had been overthrown by the February 1917 democratic bourgeois wannabe promising to be parliamentary revolution.
Right.
They intended, but obstructed and never brought about an election for a constituent assembly. So instead, the October Revolution moved the change in class rule forward from bourgeois to workers and peasants.
Right.
Now, the Bolshevik managed to overthrow the bourgeois order because in 6 months, and here we get to the Soviets, in 6 months from February to October, their power grew from a minority party to a party having majority power from within the Soviets.
Yeah.
That is, they became prominent in the Soviets. Now, the Soviets, we remember, were organs of popular self-government.
Right.
They had formed in the wake of the February Revolution in all the districts of the city. They were the work of the workers and soldiers. Within these committees, the Bolsheviks gained a gradual upper hand, though never really overwhelming compared to the socialist revolutionaries and the Mensheviks at this point, but these were the two other components of the left side of the bourgeois revolution in progress in Russia. So in this context of these 6 months, the Bolsheviks emerged as the only ones to have an organization in touch with the workers and able to mobilize them on the political objectives with concrete political objectives. The eight hour day,
right. Yep.
For example.
Yep.
And this dominance, shall we call it, made the socialist revolutionary and the Mensheviks substantially dependent on the Bolsheviks in the ability to appeal to the workers of Petrograd and organize them in the struggle. Now, the socialist revolutionaries we should define, because they become extremely important in maintaining the revolution tactically. At any rate, the socialist, best definition for the socialist revolutionaries is sort of a post-populist, neo-populist, agrarian reformers, peasant-oriented.
Yeah.
They define the peasant class not as providers of labor or distinguished from providers. Can you help me out?
Yeah,
here?
It came from the Narodniks, the populace.
They're the Narodniks, yes.
Yes, and you know, we were talking the 1860s, 1870s. Yeah, Herzen and Lavrov, some others that were
Chernov, yes.
Yeah, Chernov. And then it split. Then there were the left and the right SRs, or the SRs and the right SRs. And
in October, yes.
That's right, yeah, right at the time of the revolution. But you could see that for example, the break that takes place in the government between, say, Lenin and Kerensky over the course of the period from February to October, And we're using the Russian months for that, actually, here. It was November, you know, March and November.
Yeah.
But the split was evident. You could see that these different trends existed, you know, going back to 1905 even. We've been describing some of that. But you had at the Petrograd or the St. Petersburg Soviet, the vice chair was Kerensky. Everybody was trying to do coalition politics, basically, and also the ideological distinctions between the different groups hadn't become manifest. They weren't, you know, some people might have had them still in their heads, and they were hashing it out in the newspapers and such, but, you know, they weren't ossified ideological trends by any means at that point. It was very fluid.
Yes, that's very important.
Okay.
Now, in Stalin's assessment in 1924, or what happened in 1917, Stalin quotes Lenin and says and comments on how important the Soviets had been for this miracle that happened in Russia. Which was a miracle. I mean, it was the October Revolution,
right.
In a backward country, in feudal situations, etc. So he quotes Lenin, and he says, Stalin quotes Lenin, "Had not the popular creative spirit of the Russian Revolution, which had gone through the great experience of the year 1905, given rise to the Soviets as early as February 1917, this would have been the Kerensky Soviets,
right,
that you mentioned.
Yes.
They could not, under any circumstances, have seized power in October, because success depended entirely upon the existence of ready-made organizations, of a movement embracing millions. These ready-made forms were the Soviets. And these Soviets gradually radicalized from the Kerensky-approved Soviets in February to far more radical organizations of workers and peasants, which eventually became, to which the Bolshevik joined and helped to radicalize, or not so much helped to radicalize as grasped the potential and forwarded this radicalization.
Yeah, I mean, the peasants were, you know, some of these parties that came into being the SRs were entirely peasant groupings. And historically, there was obviously a convergence of the trajectories of the peasantry and the working class in Russia, just because of the realities of the society and the huge contradictions that existed. And so there were groupings like the SRs where these things were kind of broad coalitions of different trends. And then, you know, by the time you get to, you know, coming up into October, you have an actual program for this is what needs to change, and this is how we're going to actually govern. And you saw the Bolshevik program start to gel, which included, with respect to the peasantry, most importantly, the question of the nationalization of the land rather than redistributing it to peasants. They would take it the name of the people, and then the people would organize and arrange that through with the government.
Correct. The SRs wanted a socialization of the peasantry, whereas the Bolshevik wanted a nationalization of the peasantry,
right,
of the land, I should say.
Right.
And so Lenin goes on, these ready-made forms were the Soviets, and that is why in the political sphere there awaited us those brilliant successes.
Yeah, you know, let me just, I'm sorry, because this is something that people don't really ponder that often, and it's, and it's a big boogaboo. The question is essentially, as you change the society going forward, do you convert, do you help the peasantry become a petty bourgeoisie and ultimately a landed bourgeoisie, or do you have them become proletarians? And so how they stand in relation to the land they work, you have to look to the models that, how do the workers stand in relation to the factories in which they work and to the industry in which they work? And so the Bolsheviks were trying to harmonize this by moving forward, in their view, the peasantry to becoming workers, you know, proletarians.
Yeah, one sign of alarm, and I will continue with the quotation later. Yeah. One sign of alarm was that the most adaptable members of the Soviets, even some workers, were satisfied with some of the reforms. That is, in the early spring, let's say between February and May.
Right.
But it was then the actions of the provisional government towards war and towards the land that radicalized them.
Right.
So even the Soviets were evolving,
I mean, now they were becoming actual organs of power themselves, the people constituted in the Soviets, and a parallel, this is the thing we saw from most of the Soviet Union's history, a parallel power structure.
Yeah, and what I'm being stymied about, being really clear, is because I see that there will be a constant ongoing struggle between these accommodating elements, which are, which will be the right wing of the party, the SRs, and the Bolsheviks. And that struggle will mark the years from 1917 to the death of Stalin. I mean, eventually I want to argue that the Bolsheviks were never dominant, never managed to be dominant. I mean, to be a Bolshevik, you had to be theoretically sound, grounded, have a good deal of political, tactical, strategic, and even what would you say, what we call pragmatic here, which Lenin showed.
Oh, yeah.
He showed that kind of pragmatism, but not in the service of distorting the final goal, which was the proletarian power. In the service of proletarian power, for example, he promised the railway union in 1917 that the railway union wanted to have some sort of autonomy. And he was in charge of all communication, etc. This was early in 1917, one of the crises. And they were, you know, threatening, causing disruption, etc. And Lenin said, okay, we'll enter into a coalition. And Kamenev and Zinoviev said, oh, good, we want a coalition like that with the unions. And then, you know, Lenin said later on, shortly after, said, "Well, there will be no coalition with this union." You see?
Yes.
That was just to dampen the possibility of disruption.
Yeah, a challenge from there. Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, it's just
an example of, okay, so is this devious?
It's politics.
What would happen if everybody split into autonomy? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's politics. That's you play to win.
Yeah, so that's right. So to be a Bolshevik was really an enormously an enormous effort in education, in politics, in economics, and you know, it was a complete education, and few people could achieve that.
Right.
So, Lenin says, so the Soviets were crucial, and that's why we were successful. And he said, because they were so crucial, because the new form of political power was ready to hand. That is, we could form a government with the Soviets. And based on the Soviets, based on proletarians and peasants. And all we had to do was, by passing a few decrees, to transform the power of the Soviets from their embryonic state, in which it existed in the first months of the revolution, into a legally recognized form, which has become established in the Russian state into the Russian Soviet Republic. Stalin quoting Lenin, Stalin in 1924, Lenin earlier. But the competing form of government would have been the assembly, the constituent assembly. But let me just go on with sort of the overview, and then...
Yeah, let's do that. And and that'll be as far as we can go, because I think we got about... what do we got? We got about 5 minutes left, so let's just do a little sketch.
All right, well, then I'll just go, I hope to complete it with that. Now, the reason why the masses became attached to the Bolshevik, and this was made possible thanks to the clarity of their policy platform, which can be summarized in the words peace, bread, and land,
right,
and all power to the Soviets,
right,
which attracted a large part of the urban proletarian and of the soldiers. We have to remember, when we talk about the Constituent Assembly, we will talk about the geography, the geographical areas in Russia where who was prominent and you know, who voted, etc., for whom.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the country, it was massive. It's in 8 time zones. This is, you know, maybe there's telegraph service to parts of it, but... most of those things weren't constructed until after the revolution. Certainly the railroad from, there was no high-speed rail from Moscow to Peking, for example, or Beijing. So, you know, these places were remote from each other. That's the point. Very remote in every sense.
So, let me see how I can shorten this. Basically, the Kerensky government, especially after the repression of there was an ill-advised insurrection led by the Bolsheviks in July, to which Stalin was part. It was just ill-advised. I mean, Lenin was furious because he was in hiding in Finland, and so it was a kind of adventure. And that brought the repression on the Bolsheviks by Kerensky. So that was one thing that discredited it. And then the Kornilov affair and the inability to ensure decent conditions of existence and the continuation of the war. All of this brought the masses towards the Bolsheviks. So the credibility of the government as the executor of the will of the revolutionary masses was compromised and practically gone. And there was the betrayal and the weakness of the provisional government.
Which had almost no support in the actual, you know, it's in Petrograd. And almost nobody in Petrograd, except for the people that represented these different factions on the council, cared about them. They were not popular.
That's right. And in addition to the Soviets, what favored the revolution was that the Bolshevik Party pushed for a new government. And so under the condition of the Kerensky misgovernment, the party represented by Bukharin, that is the SR and Zinoviev, pushed for a new government of compromise, a coalition with the bourgeoisie to exit from the political crisis of the provisional government. So they wanted, that is, Bukharin and Zinoviev, wanted a new coalition with a party of cadets and with Kerensky, but a little more biased to the left. And Lenin said no. By the end of August, during the Congress of the party, during which he was absent because he was in hiding, Lenin began his campaign to push the insurrection against the provisional government of the February Revolution and replace it with something completely new. So not only were the Soviets important and crucial, but the condition of Russia and the inability of the bourgeois government to satisfy the requests of the masses, the specific historic condition of Russia made the conversion of the masses into a revolutionary mass possible. In other words, you can't repeat the Russian Revolution.
These are the things, if you were going to try to repeat it, these are the elements you'd have to have in place. Number one, which you mentioned early on, and we discussed a little further after that, there was this, you know, the development of the Soviets, which were organizations of workers. They're worker-run, worker-led, and they were places
and
where
peasants.
And peasants. And these are places where their political activity was taking place. It was a parallel, like a mass, a popular parallel structure, in essence. And
exactly.
So that's in place parallel to the government. Now the government is imploding. There's no government, only this parallel force. And now that parallel force is in a position that people inside the government can reconstitute the government in tandem with the Soviets that are outside of it. And that's the specific situation. So, all right, we got to come back to it. We're out of time.
Yep.
Luciana, thank you very much.
Thank you, Don. Bye-bye.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Worlds Apart. The current presidential campaign in Russia has featured a record number of contenders, most of whom statistically have little chance of challenging the incumbent. And that's not only because of Vladimir Putin's still enviable approval ratings, but also because after 18 years of his leadership, the prospect of power transition in Russia looks increasingly precarious. If not Putin, then whom and what? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Ksenia Sobchak, a candidate in the 2018 Russian presidential election. Ksenia, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Now, when you announced your candidacy a few months ago, you positioned yourself as a protest candidate. You said on a number of occasions that you do not intend or do not plan to win. I wonder if your strategy has changed in any way, perhaps to include something more than just getting the protest vote.
Well, first of all, I want to comment on what you said about if not Putin, then whom? I think
whom this, and what?
And what, yeah. I think a very important thing that this question by itself leads us to nowhere. It's not a good question and not a right question to ask, because it doesn't matter who, if not Putin. I would love anyone to be on his place, but the most important thing is them to change every four
years.
Well,
I strongly disagree with you, because I think the Russian history shows that the power transition is a very, very precarious
Russian history shows that we don't have experience of democratic rule. That's why most important in power transition is a change every 4 years. It doesn't matter who they are, even if they're not that effective as Putin. The most important thing is that they should change every 4 years, and they can only be two times for their lifetime. So what I fight for is that the whole system now in Russia's elections is unfair. Putin wins not because he has a big support, but because no one else can go on free TV and say what they want.
Well, now
for many
you have this opportunity, and if I may bring you back to
this opportunity I can have only for this campaign time. When I talk about free media, I talk about totally the same level of different opinions for years, and now we can see 18 years of only one position on all the federal channels in Russia.
This is the biggest problem. I actually agree with you on many of those points. I'm not arguing with that, but I want to bring you back to my original question, and that is whether you, at this point of time, whether you are aiming for something more than just the protest vote. Do you want to be that anyone else, as you just pointed out?
I want to show people of Russia that there is another point of view. This is the goal of my campaign. I know you can't win on the elections where only Putin always wins. So there is no sense of talking what would be if I would win. I will never win on the elections like in a casino where always casino wins. My goal is to speak to millions of Russians now on federal channels, because it's the only opportunity in modern Russia to speak to them during the presidential campaign, because after campaign and before campaign, they shut those doors. So my opportunity is to speak and tell them the truth. This is a rare opportunity.
Well,
and my dream to make this opportunity common for them.
Well, speaking about the truth, because I think many of the issues that you raise, I think they're pretty much in line with what the current administration preaches. For example, Putin himself said on many occasions that Russia needs more competition, both political
and economic. But he never gives it.
Economic.
So it's no. You can say between, look, truth and lies are spoken by the same words. But people always feel when person says truthful feelings or he's saying lies. So when he says I want concurrence, it's a lie, because if he wants concurrence, why he doesn't let Alexei Navalny take this in competition? Because there is a lawsuit, but you created this lawsuit not to get him
but
involved
my point
this
is that it's not only Putin, his administration ministers, for example, they say that Russian governance is not very efficient, it's too bureaucratized.
Agree with something people already see.
So what makes you different? Because you guys pretty much preach the same message.
No, not at all. The difference is huge, and this difference is in what we call real concurrence. Because what I say,
and by concurrence you mean competition, right?
Yes, by concurrence I mean competition. If Putin is really for competition, I want him to take part in debates. As all the leaders of the world, he doesn't debate for 18 years with any of his opponents. He only speaks with journalists, and this is the only idea of question and answer he gives. But I don't like this idea. I want to argue with Mr. Putin. I want not only to have his answer, but I want to ask additional question to every his answer. I don't have this opportunity now, and no one has in our country. And this is not fair. By only this thing, by a lack of debates, we can say that those elections are not fair. I want to see the same debates I saw Trump with Hillary Clinton.
Well, but I want to see
Macron on debates.
I don't understand why Putin,
if he's not afraid
of
opposition?
Well, because this is their political tradition, and our Russian political tradition is different.
This is a bad tradition. If we are talking about democracy, and Mr. Putin many times said that Russia is a democratic state. In all democratic states, and I'm a politologist, I'm quite sure in what I'm saying, there exists a tradition of debates. And Putin was asked many times to take part in those debates, and he never does. So this is not fair. If he really wants competition, okay.
Well, I agree with you.
You know all the facts. You're so strong. You're here for 18 years. I'm just a little blonde girl, you know, coming from TV shows.
Come on
and have debates with me. I'm not, you know, I'm not someone who is so much less than you that you can afford
it. Well, Ksenia, let's speak about yourself, because you made your criticism of Putin very clear, but let's leave some time.
But this is my campaign is about.
Well,
my campaign is not about me.
No, well, I'm not going to give you an easy way out of that, because
my way is only to show that those people should not be there. This is actually what my campaign is about.
My campaign is not
about Ksenia Sobchak. My campaign is candidate against all.
Well,
it's
Ksenia, good try, but I do want to ask a few questions about yourself. You said, for example, just the other day that governing class, you view governing class as hired professionals. And I agree with you on that we, the people, hire those professionals to do the job for us. And yet you yourself have no governing experience From what I know, you have no major managerial experience. You do not have the experience of making decisions under stress and under sometimes competing priorities.
I had so much stress during raids in my life. I had so much stress.
I'm asking you about professional experience of making decisions.
Exactly.
If you believe in running the country on the professional basis, what makes you qualified for the position that you're running
for? I'm believing that my country should be run by professional managers and by professionals. But president is not a person who is doing, you know, some expert work. As we remember,
he's
Valenza,
responsible for making decisions.
I've never said that a president should be a, you know, one field expert. President is someone who, in my point of view, is a guarantee of constitution.
Well, in
this
the Russian governing
aim.
System, president has the biggest
so now
authority
I see
of all
that
the
you are not prepared for the interview because you haven't read my program. As you know, in my program, the first point I make that I am against presidential republic. I want a parliamentary republic in Russia, and in parliamentary republic, the main and only biggest function of president is a guarantee of constitution. So, Valenza or Václav Gavel were not professionals, but they were one of the best leaders of the world, to my point of view, because they were brave enough to go out to people and say, look, I want to unite you all, and I think what we're doing is right, and what they are doing is wrong. So I want, this is an example for me. I am a person who wants to guarantee that the constitution written by my father, by the way, will be really guaranteed in this country. And I want parliament to decide all the important laws for my country.
So what you're saying is that the parliament has to be professional, but not the president. The president does not need to.
I say that we don't need presidential republic. We don't need one person's rule. A president should be a guarantor of constitution.
I bet that even Václav Gavel will disagree
with
that.
So Václav Gavel was not a professional, as you know, when he became a president. He was not a politician. He even said, I'm not a politician. I'm just a person who cares. So I'm also a person who cares. And in the state where politics was killed, all the professionals were suppressed so that they couldn't take part in politics if they are positioners. So in this situation, now we just need brave people who are not afraid. So now I'm just a brave person who says, look, I'm not afraid. And unfortunately, this is already enough now to go and fight for power because all the people are really afraid of what's going on in Russia. They are suffering with fear. That's why those professionals who should rule, they're sitting at home, their doors locked, and they're afraid of the government. So they don't go out on the streets, they don't vote.
Well, they took to the streets just yesterday, but...
No, this is not true again. Look how you're lying. You're lying.
I'm not lying.
They didn't go on the streets.
People
because
took to the streets
unsanctioned
yesterday.
Because the government didn't approve these meetings, and they said everywhere, if you go out, we will put you to police.
You just accused me of lying. I said people took to the streets, not that the government approved of that.
What do you mean regardless of unconstitutional
did people
things? You can't
take to the streets on Sunday to support your former associate
Alexei
Navalny.
This is what usually propaganda does. I will explain you by fingers. They say, look, people didn't go out on the streets. And when I try to say they didn't go out on the streets, not because there are not so many people who support
it. They did take
to
the streets.
Not a lot of people went on the streets. Only 2,000 people. It's really not the number.
They are not the people.
Hundreds of thousands of people in Russia would love to go on the streets, but they are not allowed because government says...
I think
if you
people
go
in
the
Russia
street,
are far more
if you go
freer
street,
than you,
you
give them credit for.
To jail. This is what government always says. They don't give sanction to those meetings. They say, no, this is not confirmed as a meeting. So they do everything to make people frightened of them.
Well,
so this
you are
is
obviously not frightened. Let me
this
ask you...
This is the politics of our country, unfortunately.
Speaking about the politics of our country, one of your very consistent criticisms of the current government is that it hasn't done something. For example, it hasn't reined in corruption. I agree with that. It hasn't invested in non-hydrocarbon industry. It hasn't done much of that, but this the same argument the same didn't do argument could be equally applied to you.
No,
you
haven't, it cannot apply
you
to
haven't
me.
Run
I'm not
an
a
NGO. You haven't run an NGO fighting for people's
it
rights.
It cannot.
You haven't started an innovative business.
To me.
You haven't done
I
much
had.
In the way of public
I
service.
I have, unfortunately, you don't know much about me because I had started an innovative business. I have a big agency who works in internet, selling advertisements, selling
how does it
things.
Count for public service?
Why I should do something for public service if I only begin my political
that,
career?
That is my question. Why would you, if you take your bid seriously,
I,
why
I'm
don't you...
I'm a very successful businessman in my past. I had my restaurants, which I ruled for many years and got a good revenues for that. I made a big business on advertisement. I sold it because I went to my political career. So my political career is only starting, and I hope on this way to make lots of things. And I don't think it's quite correct to ask the same things of a businessman, Ksenia Sobchak, who was doing business and successful business for many years, and from president, who should be doing
I'm
this
I'm not comparing
things.
You, but...
You are. You're saying, but these things could be applied to me. What
the
things
same
can be applied
didn't
to
do,
me?
Didn't do
didn't
argument.
Didn't do for 10 years economy of the country, but I was not Putin.
But you haven't run an NGO, for example.
What do you mean? I was doing my own business, and
but if you run for the position of the president, I would assume, maybe I'm wrong, that it requires a certain degree of public involvement, of
now,
public service.
I'm sorry, in the country which is autocratic like Russia, there only one quality you need to run a presidency. One quality that Alexei Navalny and I share. It's the braveness. Because people who go against Putin, they end their life in prison. And you know this for sure. So to be a highly developed, you know, a manager, this is unfortunately not enough now. You have to be brave. And after those people like me will break this wall of autocracy, then those managers can come out and rule. And this is my goal. I don't want to cede powers. I want to break this wall of autocratic regime.
Okay, Ksenia, for the time being, we have to take a very, very short break, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Ksenia Sobchak, a candidate in the 2018 Russian presidential election. Ksenia, just before the break, you mentioned the name of Alexei Navalny, I assume a former friend of yours who is precluded from running in these elections. And his supporters took to the streets in a series of unsanctioned rallies just the other day. Apparently, you didn't make much of it, but I think that was a notable event, and they defied the government several times before.
It was only 2,000 people. It's not all the supporters of the idea.
Well, given
the meetings are unsanctioned, this is what I mean.
Well, given
first
the tyrannical atmosphere that you just put out, that
first you don't let people go on the streets, and then they say, only 2,000. Ah, no support of opposition. Thousands of people would go out.
Ksenia, you're arguing with yourself now, because I said that people took to the streets, and you earlier denied that or tried to argue that.
What do you mean, took the streets? Yeah, they took 2,000 people. It's not enough. It's not what you said. You said, but look, people went out.
They did go out.
They did, but small quantity was not because it was small quantity, but because the meetings were
I never
were
tried
banned.
To qualify it. You tried to do that, but let's stop wrangling about it. I think the reason why people took to the streets and why Alexei Navalny called them to go out was his call for the boycott of those elections. And boycott means not participating at all. Isn't he the real protest candidate, the candidate who is really against all, rather than, let's say,
yes,
you?
I think he's a real candidate, and I think that he should be led to the elections. Unfortunately, that was not made. And here we share different ideas, because I don't think that boycott is effective. I think boycott will play only on Putin, not against Putin, because the less number of people would come and vote out of protestants, the more percentage of those who come will be for Putin. This is obvious, and I'm against this idea. That's why I decided to participate, to unite those who go and vote on those elections to say how many people are against, so that you Putin earlier, would not get any vote.
You earlier accused the current authorities of trying to downplay the opposition support in Russia. I know that, I mean, everybody knows that there has been a bit of a falling out between your campaign and Navalny campaign. There has been a number of very public spats. Yesterday, Alexei Navalny published a comment that was not very complimentary of the post in which you were tagged.
What do you mean?
Well, I think he accused, there was a rumor that you visited him in the detention facility. Somebody wrote about you visiting him in the detention facility, to which he replied that it was a lie. Anyway, it's clear.
But what does it have to do with me? I did my best. I brought some food. I spoke with policemen. I never said I saw him personally.
Yeah, but it shows that there is... not the kind of agreement between various opposition forces, or even goodwill.
That happens because this is what I share as democracy. You shouldn't be all agreed like this, like all the people who work around Putin.
There are lots of personal attacks. If you guys are united by the common goal, which is bringing more...
I don't do any personal attacks, so this is not a question to me. I think you better ask Alexei.
But you did chase his campaign manager on camera.
No, but I never do personal attacks. I just wanted him to apologize.
But he certainly didn't show the opposition in the very pleasant
light. Yeah, but
I
can only answer for myself. I can't answer for other people. Yes, I think some of the moves Alexei did and other opposition leaders did were not really sensible in terms of uniting us all. But I try to do everything to
avoid
this.
But when you chased his campaign manager quite deliberately...
I was not chasing, I just wanted his apologies, I didn't get them, and then I finished
the
subject.
Don't you think that by doing that, you are playing in the hands of those who actually are looking for any pretext to discredit the opposition?
If you come and say, please apologize because you said lie, I don't think it plays on someone's ground.
That's up to you. You said that you share a lot of common ideas, and I think politically, and Navalny stands on both leftist and nationalist positions. He is on record saying that when he comes to power, he is going to expropriate the properties of the current elite. And I think in Russia, that is something that could be very appealing to the people, especially the poor, the young. Would you personally like to see another expropriation redistribution campaign in this country?
Well, I think we should be very definite in our terms. I don't think that he says about expropriation of the elite. I think he, in his program, and if I'm not mistaken, speaks about expropriation of the people connected with corruption. With this, I totally agree.
You know that he's not just the leftist. I think he's a revolutionary leftist. He's pretty much about, blowing up the current system and building something new in its place. And that is a fundamental question for Russia. How do you change Russia? Whether you change it from scratch, starting to build from a clean slate, or whether you work with the current system. It's very important for me to get your position on that. Are you in favor of revolution or evolution?
Our view of future Russia is really different because I think that, unfortunately, the only good way for us is a long way. I know that many people want a fast change, but fast change only happens as a revolution. I'm against revolution.
On that, you agree with Putin rather than with Navalny.
Look, what do you mean I agree? I don't agree with Putin. Putin doesn't say the real things about this. You know, if a person says, I'm for everything good and against everything bad, of course you will agree with him.
He specifically articulated that he prefers an incremental change in Russia.
But then why he doesn't do it for 18 years? He knows that Rotenberg steals. He knows that that Timchenko is probably stealing. He knows many, many governmental people who are stealing from the state. Why he's not punishing them? Why he's only punishing Ulyukayev, who stole from Sechin? And he's punished not because he stole from state, but because he stole something from
And
Sechin.
You really believe that Putin has the same, that kind of authority to deliberately target any given individual in our country?
I know that Putin has all the powers in Russia. And his word is the last word in our
But
country.
You understand that in such a big country like Russia, not every question could be addressed to a president, for sure.
Of course, and that's the problem, because all the people around him sit and think, okay, what Putin may think about this? Or maybe we intrigue that Putin already said to us we can do this. And then hundreds of intrigue has become the reality of our life. But the problem is that we don't have law, we have intrigue. intrigues around what Putin will think about this. And this is, I think, a really bad situation, because I want to live in a country where everything is ruled by law, not by president.
Well, I think many people would agree with you on that, but I think the problem in Russia is not what, but how. And this is actually what Anatoly Chubais, one of the architects of liberal reform in Russia, said recently at the Gaidar Forum, that the problem is not, we all agree that the Russian future is democratic, but the question is how to change that. And from his position, it's not just about political will, it's about the energized citizenry. What have you done in your campaign to encourage that citizen muscle?
I've done a huge tour. I visited more than 18 regions of Russia already. And in every city, I gather big halls where I speak with people. I talk about the need for change. I talk about the problems we face. I agitate all around Russia. And my main goal is education. I want to educate people. I want to bring them truth. And I want to gather all their problems to make them federal. So I go on all the regions of Russia and I gather those problems. And I want, you
can
know,
can I ask
all
you specifically about that? Because I've been following your campaign, and sometimes it really looks like a more hip version of Putin's annual call-in show, because you would go to some rundown hospital, people will tell you how bad things are, and they would be hoping that the publicity will make the local officials pay attention. But it's the same old Russian paternalism, waiting for the officials to fix the problem rather than being the change you want to see in the world. Don't you think that you are essentially playing the very same Kremlin tactic?
No, I'm not. I'm the change people want to see, because with me comes the light to their problems. When I come to those hospitals...
But are you the change that you want to see in Russia, that you want to see in the world? Somebody who actually... who not only talks about the problems, but who fixes them.
I fix them by doing this. This is my way of fixing. You know, you
just
can
drawing
fix...
publicity to it during the last.
Yes, of course, because after drawing
publicity...
But that
publicity, doesn't solve the problem in and of
what
itself.
What do you mean? I can give you already some examples. For example, the hospital we met, already they're now pronouncing a program of, building works because of my visit. And this is the real doing thing, because I can't take those money out of my pocket and build a hospital.
They're being fixed by the same Putin system that you criticize. So you drew the attention to the problem.
No, I'm saying, look, those guys got money for building a hospital, but they never built it. They never rebuilt it. Then I come with TV and everyone writes about this. They know they stole those money and they have to do something, because otherwise they will go to prison, because the scandal around this becomes really huge. So what they're doing, they compensate it and start building it. This is how I fix things. This is my way of doing. I go, for example, and speak about
but
people
who
are put to
prison. But you do understand that the presidential work is not drawing attention to some problem. It's
yes,
actually
of course, but I'm doing now what I can do now. I was talking loud about Yuri Dmitriev, among with other very famous people who were also against these charges that were
built
on
him. He was released. Do you take the credit for that?
He was released. I take on all of us this credit. On all the citizens who were involved in doing something for him to make this case public. And when you say what you do if you are only talking, you know, talking, as you remember in Bible, first was the word. So talking is the most important thing. When you start talking about things that were never talked
about, I think Russians are exploiting this fable
changed,
too much. They like to talk, but they don't like doing
no,
that.
No, no one likes to talk. No one on federal channels talks about the things I talk. And people know this, and that's why they go and want to support me.
Now, I want to squeeze two more questions, if I may. And we don't have that much time, so I would appreciate a relatively short answer. You're, I think, one of the first prominent female candidates in the Russian elections after Irina Khakamada. And if you read her interviews, she encountered a lot of sexism, and not just sexism, she encountered a lot of open bigotry. And her negatives were very high, but not as high as yours. I saw some polling agencies putting them down to 80%. Do you think that's just the typical prejudice of the Russian electorate against women, or do you put that more to your own personality?
Well, first of all, I don't believe in those kind of polls, because those polls done in the same ways as everything, as they count votes. It's like the same kind of organizations. And
so you do not think you have the negative?
No, I don't see it around me. I see so much support, especially when I go out of big cities. I see much support of people who come, like,
This is a statistical fact that women in many countries do encounter more challenges running for the office.
I feel it too sometimes. But I think we shouldn't pay attention to this. We just should do what I think is right because, well, yes, it exists. Many men don't think that it's a right for a woman to rule their life. They don't think that in patriarchal society that's a good thing to do. But what we can do about this? We can just prove that this is not right. But
well,
what
I think you're far less agreeable than most Russian women. You certainly know how to get your way. And I have one last question. I don't want you to take it as a personal attack. I think it's an important one. A few years ago, you were taped having a conversation with your neighbors about the repair works in your apartment building.
I don't think it's correct to discuss criminal case because this was a private talk on telephone, which was...
Was it
done by FSB, so it's a criminal case and it was criminally reported, so I don't think it's ethical to discuss my private telephone conversations with anyone.
But in that private telephone conversation...
No, I don't think it's correct to discuss any private conversations or my private analysis.
Cindy, you are bold enough, lady.
It's a criminal case and you know this. It's unconstitutional to do this, to discuss it, and even to report it. If you would show this on your TV, I will write it on Roskomnadzor, and they will close it because it's unlawful. I won't do this, but I'm just saying you, we can't discuss unlawful things. It's unconstitutional.
But you know, many of Alexei Navalny's movies are deemed unconstitutional in this country.
No, his movies are discussing corruption.
Cindy, I'm going to
and
ask
showing palace. Of the people. Look how you do it. This we discuss.
Please don't
of the people.
Please
who
don't
build on my money and
we
yours
are
money.
Talking about
and
how you want relate to discuss to other people.
My telephone, private telephone.
In
call.
Which
no.
you said that you wouldn't care.
I'm not going.
You wouldn't care more.
It's illegal to discuss my telephone calls.
Listen,
if you're working with FSB, who took these calls? Once again, if you're cooperating with them,
I think
you can do a certain other.
Listen, millions of people in Russia listen. To
do
that call.
I don't want to listen to any calls. I'm not listening to Nemtsov calls, who was killed.
Okay, let me.
Whose calls were also there. So no, I won't discuss my private calls, which were illegally taped by FSB. As I was not listening and never would listen to Nemtsov calls that were also distributed through all the internet.
Cindy, let me ask you a question.
I think it's something that people don't do. It's unethical, and my mother.
It's unethical.
It's unethical because it's my private. I can say in my home whatever I think is right, and in my letters, private letters, I can write whatever I think is right. And my mother said to me that I should never read someone's SMS, someone's letters, and discuss some phone calls.
Didn't your mother tell you that you should be nicer to people when you talk on the phone?
So I was never doing this. And to my advice to you, be ethical enough not to read some other private letters, you know?
No, but it's an important question for me as a person.
This is an illegal question. Again,
it's
this
not
is
an illegal
FSB
question.
And my private life.
Because we are running out of time.
Okay,
let me pose it in a way that would not impeach on that call, but I will still have the same message across. You're known as somebody who has a very snobbish attitude to other people, and I think you demonstrated that in that call.
How? Can you explain, apart from this call, which was my private life and which was taped, and now can you give another example of this snobbish attitude?
I think the...
Just one. Give me journalistic example.
Well, I think...
One legal journalistic example.
Well, even now, I think you are... As a journalist, I think this is, you don't want to discuss this problem. I understand why.
It's illegal.
But,
it's because it's illegal.
But
so
anyway,
I'm not snobbish and I'm asking
the job
just
of
for
a president requires a certain degree of consideration for the other people, a genuine accommodation of their concerns. Do you think you have it in yourself to show that accommodation to people who live next door to you, to people who live across the street, or to people who live at the other end of the country.
Of course, this is what I'm doing now, and this is actually what my campaign is about. Actually, this campaign changed me a lot too, because when I go to people, when I see how many problems they have, and when I see that I cannot solve them all right now. I'm trying hard. I'm doing my best. But I see that sometimes I can only hug them. I can only cry with them. And that's maximum that I can do. Of course, it touched me very much. And it touches me now. And actually, I'm not a person I used to be when I came to this campaign and now. Because I saw so many suffering already. And I am now every day with it. So, of course, it gives me a huge burden when you can do only so little things now, but you see how many people are really needing help and support and a fair state, and they don't have it now.
Since we are already grossly over time, we will have to post the whole version online and make some changes that we will agree with you for the air version.
No, let's then stop it, not to make any changes.
But we are already over time. But
yeah, let's finish it. Thank you so much. I really don't want you to cut the interview. Thank you. It was nice meeting you.
You are not going to accommodate my last question?
I just don't want you to cut anything. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.